My friend, from April 29 to the 1st of May, I am running my free 3-day six-figure solopreneur challenge. Now, if you are a coach, consultant, or service provider, I'm going to teach you how to scale your business without burning out, without spending a cent on ads, without sleazy sales tactics, and without needing a huge audience. I will teach you how to upgrade your mindset to be able to call in this type of business and abundance. I'm going to teach you how to simplify to amplify your business, how to craft an irresistible offer that your dream clients are bursting to work with you, how to unlock a flood of organic leads, and how to master the art of the no-pressure sales calls that still convert like crazy, plus so much more. If you want the business of your dreams, making the income and impact of your dreams, register for free at shelaunch.com. I can't wait to see you there. In episode 563 with Dr. Isaac Golden, we are diving deep into the world of homeopathy with a big focus on vaccine injuries, the autism spectrum, plus so much more.
The Melissa Ambrosini Show.
Welcome to the Melissa Ambrosini Show. I'm your host, Melissa, best-selling author of Mastering Your Mean Girl, Open Wide, Comparisonitis, and Time Magic. And I'm here to remind you that love is sexy, healthy is liberating, and wealthy isn't a dirty word. Each week, I'll be getting up close and personal with thought leaders from around the globe, as well as your weekly dose of motivation so that you can create epic change in your own life and become the best version of yourself possible. Are you ready, beautiful? Hey, beautiful, and welcome back to the show. I'm so excited about this episode because I absolutely love all things natural health and healing, and I love homeopathy, and I've been using it in my home for over 10 years. And today's guest is the godfather of homeopathy, Dr. Isaac Golden. He has been a homeopathic practitioner since 1984 and teaching since 1988. He founded the Australasian College of Homeopathy in 1990, which offers distance education courses in homeopathic and natural medicine. He is a regular contributor to local and international academic journals and the founder of 11 books on homeopathy. And he is a world authority on homeopathy. And he was the first person to be awarded a PhD from a mainstream Australian university for research on a homeopathic topic. Now, in his clinic, he specializes in the treatment of vaccine injuries and especially children on the autism spectrum. So if you know anyone who is on the autism spectrum or who has vaccine injuries, you're going to love this episode. And for everything that we mentioned in today's conversation, you can check out in the show notes, and that's over at melissaambrosini.com/563. Now, without further ado, let's bring on the incredible Dr. Isaac Golden. Isaac, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you here. But before we dive in, can you tell us what you had for breakfast this morning?
That could be embarrassing, but it's not. My wife is a very experienced naturopath and nurse and diabetes educator, makes a special cereal in her Thermomix. I don't know if you know what one of those is, but it's a machine that blends a whole lot of things together very effectively. And so I have that most mornings, not always. In the mornings when I've got to rush away and play golf, I usually have a crunchy granola or something along those lines because it's quick and easy. The other ones need to absorb the fluid a little bit. Now, I found that very good start to the day.
Yeah, beautiful. Now, I've had Melissa Kupsch on the podcast. That was episode 555. And we spoke about homeopathy, how it works and what it's good for. But I would absolutely love to hear how you got into this. You have been practicing since 1984, but your passion for it started before that. So how did it all begin for you? Like, did you have parents that were interested in natural health? How did this happen?
Well, my professional training as a young person was in economics and statistics and company finance and financial accounting. My dear old dad ran a finance company, which he'd started himself. So no, my early training and everything was totally different, but I always was interested in things to try and make one a bit healthier than one otherwise might be. And I mean, back in my early 20s, a little bit of reflexology, for example, which I remember buying a book by an elderly American lady. I forget her name now. And so I practiced on my friends and they practiced on me, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, have a certain degree of awareness, but about good food and all that. But it wasn't until the late 70s when I started to move towards the decision to change my career path. One of my own children was vaccine injured, and there was very little information around in those days. That dear old American professor, Professor Robert Mendelsohn, I don't know if you're familiar with him, that he actually came to Australia for a lecture tour. And the AMA in Australia, of course, treated him very badly, even though he was an orthodox professor of medicine. He had a bit to say about vaccines. And in the late 70s, early 80s, I decided, I'd start moving towards changing my career path. I had no idea what homeopathy was then. And I started studying things like, you know, the flower essences, tissue salts, herbs, as well as some nutritional stuff. And then when someone introduced me to homeopathy and I started to read a little bit about it, it was sort of love at first sight. So I knew that was what I wanted to do, but I still didn't know about homeopathic immunization. It was not really taught in the very simple little studies that I had done to begin with. And then I read an essay by the founder of homeopathy, Dr. Samuel Hahnemann, called The Cure and Prevention of Scarlet Fever. And he described, that was published in 1801, and he described an episode in Germany in 1799 where he actually used homeopathic potency of the remedy belladonna to both treat and also prevent scarlet fever. Well, that was a complete eye-opener to me. And I thought, well, if I had known this as a parent, not that I was ever offered any options to vaccination back then. I mean, that was all that was going around. I thought if I had been offered or had known about this option as a parent, it would have been something I would have used. And so I decided to collect as much information as I could about homeoprophylaxis, which was very little. I mean, there were a lot of old journal entries about this professor or this doctor or this practitioner had used certain remedies in usually epidemic situations with great success, but there was virtually no data. In fact, I think the first data I ever saw was from a Dr. Charles Eaton in America treating the smallpox epidemic. And he and a group of other doctors, they got together and collected some data, and they showed a wonderful result in the 90% in terms of prophylaxis, preventing smallpox. And so in 1985, I decided I would develop a program that if parents who wanted an option to the orthodox vaccination schedule at the time, they would be able to get an option. And of course, back then, of course, the number of vaccines being used is a fraction of what it is now. So it was a very easy and simple task back then. And so I started to make that available. And I started in 1986 to collect data from the parents who were using it, because this is where the old economics background came in useful with statistics and all that sort of stuff. And so one thing led to another, and I started to publish the early results and then started to write a number of books, which developed over the years as well. And then in 2000 to 2004, I did a PhD at Swinburne University in Melbourne. And looking at the data I'd collected from 1986, basically to 2002. And so that made a very big difference in terms of, I did that because I wanted orthodox people to be my supervisors. And one was a professor of medicine and the other one was a medical epidemiologist. So they were perfect people to say, no, this is the wrong way to do it, or this is a better way to do it in terms of looking at the data. And after that, things really did change. I was invited by the Cuban government in 2008 to attend a big conference that they'd organized talking about homeopathic immunization, because in 2007 and earlier in 2008, they'd had a big problem with leptospirosis, in particularly in the eastern states or provinces of Cuba. And so I got there and they very kindly invited me to be the lead speaker, and I got up and I presented all my data, you know, and some thousands of people. It was very impressive. The Cubans got up and they talked about treating 2.3 million people homeopathically to prevent leptospirosis and the results they had. I mean, I was sitting there with my mouth open like a little kid in a lolly shop. And so that led to a wonderful relationship with the people at the Finlay Institute. I went back to Cuba another three times, working with them at the Institute collecting data. And actually the person who was the vice president of Finlay is now living in Australia, in Adelaide, with his beautiful family, and they've become Australian citizens. So we recently worked on an article for homeopathic links and talking about the effectiveness of homeopathic immunization for, if you like, traditional diseases compared to the effectiveness for COVID. Because, you know, we had COVID immunization available in February 2020. Absolutely dreadful. But of course, we're not allowed to talk about it. I don't know how much you want to get into this later on, but there's a lot to say if you do and nothing to say if it's not wise. But I'll leave that up to you, Melissa. And so I went to India then five times, 2015 onwards, working with the people at CCR, at the Central Council for Research in Homeopathy, which is part of the Ministry of Ayush. So in India, they've got the Orthodox Ministry of Health and then the Ministry of Ayush, which is effectively the Ministry of Natural Medicine. It's a wonderful system. It's a wonderful system. The H in Ayush is homeopathy. And so they were very happy to share data with me, and we worked on a whole lot of stuff. So that's a very quick summary of how I got into it.
Thank you so much for sharing that. How many kids do you have?
Lots.
Can you tell me all their ages? Like, what's the eldest and the youngest?
Well, I think they range from about 50 to about 30.
Wow.
Nothing like that. I'm dreadful with that. Let me put it this way. We can have a good game of basketball if we all got together.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So this is really interesting, because how I first discovered you was probably about 5 years ago, when a friend told me that she was doing your homeopathic immunization protocol for her child. And she said, Dr. Isaac Golden. And I was like, how have I never heard of this man? And she shared the protocol, like she was showing me all of the protocol that you'd done, and she had it printed out and stuck up in her kitchen, and she was doing it. So she was showing me all of that. And I was just like, wow, okay. I am well-versed in the health and wellness industry. This was 5 years ago, and I had never heard of this. So my mind was blown. And I just love that, you know, there's that option out there for people. So can you talk to us about the effectiveness of being immunized homeopathically?
Right. So that's the most important thing in a way, because we know that the method itself is safe. Like when you use energy medicines like homeopathy, there are no molecules of any diseases in the remedies themselves. Therefore, a person can't catch the disease. There's no aluminium, formaldehyde, all the other sorts of things. So we know that there can't be any toxic effect. So the real question is, how effective is it? Because there's no point in having something that's safe if it doesn't work. And that's really been the focus of what I've done and tried to contribute to the international debate since the mid-80s. And that's why I've, you know, gone overseas collecting data where I've been able to, from governments and other people. For those of your listeners who are interested, if they wanted to go onto my webpage, which is a very simple one, it's three W's, HOM study, like homeopathy study, HOM study, study.net. there's a page there which has a lot of information with evidence, but just underneath the second video, there's a link to an article that people can download for free. And it talks about use of homeopathic immunization by government agencies in other countries in over 250 million doses of medicine. And this is the tip of the iceberg. It's only looking at about a 30-year period. The method itself's been used for as long as vaccines, 220 years. And it's only looking at three countries. So it's a much wider use that's available. But it's a compelling collection of evidence because there's so much of it. And most of it is done by orthodox government authorities in those countries. And even though every study that has ever been published in orthodox or complementary medical journals can be criticized, every study has weaknesses. When you get massive amounts of data like this, it's compelling. And what it suggests is that the level of protection is around 90%. And that's very comparable with orthodox vaccines. In fact, the editor of the journal Vaccine, which is the most pro-vaccine journal on the planet, Orthodox Medicine, Dr. Poland, he came out about a decade ago and said it's impossible for vaccines to be 99% effective. The best ones will maybe be 90% effective. And that was a very wise and a very accurate statement. But there are some vaccines now in Australia, and I'm sure it's similar in other countries, like, for example, the whooping cough vaccine. Now, it used to be in the 80s. It's now probably about 65% effective because the strain of the disease in the community has changed, whereas the strain used in most of the vaccines has not. And the thing with vaccination is that it requires a lock and key effect. The antibody and the antigen have to match really well in order to get the maximum level of protection. But homeopathic immunization is not an attempt to mimic or copy vaccination. The end result is similar. You know, we want someone who's exposed to a disease to not develop symptoms, or if they're developed, to be very temporary and mild. But the way that it's done is totally different. But in terms of data, if people want to go on and download that article, as I said, you can download it for free. You can print it out and show people. It's not private or secret information. It was actually a summary of two articles I published in peer-reviewed journals, one in America and one in Australia in 2019. And this is a sort of summary of that. And one doesn't have to remember all the details, but you can see there that there's a lot of evidence behind what we do. And that evidence really started in 1799 when Hahnemann first described his use of, as I said, belladonna to both cure and prevent scarlet fever.
So fascinating. So I personally know a few people who have had a vaccine injury, and you work with a lot of children who have had vaccine injuries and a lot of children on the autism spectrum. So how does homeopathy help those children who are on the spectrum or who have had an injury from vaccines?
By the way, I'm these days, since COVID, seeing more adults with vaccine injury than children at the moment.
Yes, I know quite a few as well.
And I really don't think there'd be anyone in Australia who doesn't know someone. Although, you know, closed minds can keep details at bay if they wish. Okay, so as I said, I developed my first immunization program in 1985. And the other side of that coin is, of course, vaccine injury. And this was what got me really into it to begin with. The fact that my older children were vaccinated and one of them, as I said, was vaccine injured. So that made me very aware of the issues that parents have to face and also the range of problems. So in 1986, I started to get, you know, I had only had a very small practice at the time. I started to get some inquiries about vaccine injured children. With homeopathy, we can make remedies from anything, and literally, including, you know, the carpet on your floor or the curtains on your windows. If you're allergic to them, you can person can take the remedy and hopefully desensitize. But we can also make homeopathic potencies of vaccines. And so they're in the method that I use, they are the keys to getting to the heart of treating vaccine injury. And look, it does depend on the case history, but I mean, time and time again, I get parents who have told me over the years, my son or daughter, they were progressing well up to 12 months of age. They were starting to say a few words. There was great eye contact. Hugs and cuddles weren't a problem. They weren't afraid of other people. And then within 1 or 2 weeks of the 12-month, or in some cases the 18-month vaccine, that had all changed. That's a very common story for children on the spectrum. Now, I'm not for one moment saying that vaccines are the only causes of autism. They're not. But they are a major cause. And the fact that is not recognized and accepted by orthodox medicine is a tragedy, because when you get a case history like that, the cause is obvious. And so if you treat the cause, the people will change. And so I've got, once again, I love my statistics. So I started to collect data. And what I did, I mapped the symptoms that the patients were coming in with, including autism, but a whole range of other physical as well as mental emotional symptoms. And I mapped whether the treatment was successful in removing those symptoms. Now, the only way that a homeopathic potency of, say, the MMR vaccine could cause eye contact to be resumed, language to start coming back, the child starting to mix with other children and progress at school, all this sort of wonderful stuff. The only way potencies of the MMR vaccine could help that happen would be if the vaccine, the MMR vaccine, was the cause. So in other words, with the wisdom of hindsight, by mapping the symptoms that had been cured, it gave us a wonderful profile, statistically, of the symptoms the different vaccines cause. And the profiles of the different vaccines were, of course, most of the time, very different. And particularly when you look at the DPT Hexa group and the MMR-MMRV group, they're the two major groups where symptoms seem to be most frequently activated by the vaccines. And the symptom profiles based on, you know, mental, emotional, and physical symptoms are very different. Actually, the reason one does research is to find out things you never knew before. And I've just last year, at the end of last year, published the fourth edition of my book on vaccine injured children. And I had enough data to actually map the symptom profile of the varicella or chickenpox vaccine. And to my absolute amazement, it was almost a mirror image of the MMR vaccine. And this is most unusual because all of them have quite unique symptom profiles. And now, of course, we have the MMRV vaccine at 18 months, where they've added the varicella vaccine to the MMR that is usually given at 12 months. So it's a bit like a double whammy. You've got these two lots of things which have a very similar symptom profile being used in the one vaccine now. So it's a lot more complicated than that. And potencies of the vaccines are not always enough, and they're not always the best remedy to use in every case. And as I said, there are cases, I have very few, of children who were diagnosed on the spectrum who were not vaccinated. Now, there's probably half a dozen I can think of over the years. And in every one of those cases, the child had some sort of, if you like, toxic trauma at birth. So like antibiotics at birth is a very good example, because I think about half of them, that was the one thing in their history. They weren't vaccinated, but for whatever reason, you know, there might have been problems with the delivery or problems with the pregnancy or something with the child themselves. They needed heavy antibiotic treatment at birth. And so if you use, I use a remedy, which is a homeopathic potency of antibiotic toxins. And once again, I was amazed to see the difference that using that remedy made to the autistic symptoms. Once again, eye contact improving, language improving, empathy improving, all that sort of thing. So there's a lot to it, but at the heart of it is that ability to use homeopathic potencies of the vaccines.
Thank you so much for sharing that. So what are some signs that parents can look for? You know, you said speech delays, eye contact, all of those things. Is there anything else that parents can kind of look for if they think that their child may have an injury from a vaccine?
The answer is there are dozens of other things one can look for. And particularly when I first started, the DPT group of vaccines, diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, pertussis, were the main ones that I was seeing because the MMR had not been used then. And a lot of the, on the physical side, epilepsy was a very common one. In fact, I think the very first major, which were for me was so revealing, case that I had was of a 16-year-old girl who had been on Epilin virtually all her life. The mother brought her in. She didn't say a word herself during the first consultation. She just sat there with her head down. She hadn't finished school. She was working in a sheltered workshop. And, you know, her mum brought her in and said, look, is there anything you can do? So I took a case history, and the case history said that the epileptic seizures started shortly after one of the DPT vaccines. So I sent her away with the potency of the DPT vaccine and said, you know, come back in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. We'll see what we'll do. And for goodness sake, don't stop the Epilin. We'll talk about that then. Anyway, they came back in a bit over three weeks, and the young girl walked in with a big smile on her face, sat down, said hello. You know, it was a remarkable change in such a short period of time. Mainly I was talking to the mum, and mum said, you know, it's really great. And I said, well, you know, maybe we should now talk about slowly reducing the Epilin because you've got to be so careful with these things. And she said, oh, no, we stopped that a week ago. So I was sort of a bit shocked. I'll never forget. It was the nicest shock I've had in my life, I think, because it was just to see the transformation in this young lass. And long story, after about, when she was about 18 or 19, her mum just called me up and said, look, everything's fine. Just want to let you know she's just got engaged. And this was someone who prospect for a life was pretty dreadful. So there are many other symptoms on, as I said, mental, emotional, physical. One of the other big grouping of symptoms around the DPT vaccine was ADHD. And that was seen back then, you know, 40 years ago as being much more of a problem than autism. But of course, now you hear much more about autism than ADHD. And there was I'll just share another little quick anecdote, if that's all right. Another case that I'll never forget is I would have seen him when he was about 5, I think. And once again, his mum brought him in. He had no language, no eye contact with her or any of the family, really no empathy at all. He was, you know, been diagnosed and been on the spectrum. It was so clear. And of course, he didn't go to school. We started treating with potencies of the MMR vaccine because that was the one that was clearly indicated when taking the case. And after about 2 years, he'd progressively come out of himself, and he'd gone from someone who didn't say a word to someone who wouldn't shut up. He would just talk and talk. So funny, actually. And then after a couple of years, she came in and she said, you know, the doctor has now said he's no longer autistic, but he's now got ADHD because he wouldn't shut up. He kept, you know, he wasn't the go. He was wanting to do this, that, and everything else. But the most lovely thing was a couple of years after that, he'd gone into normal school and he was in the top 3 students in his class.
Wow.
See, that is, I wish I could say that about every case. You know, I've talked about a couple of successes, but of course, I, like every other practitioner, have failures where we haven't been able to help as much as we would have liked. But when you see people's lives changing, I mean, it is so rewarding.
And their families.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's not just them, their families as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's so beautiful.
Well, it's been my blessing over the last 40 years to have got into that area. It was a natural fit, I think, given my background with my own daughter. And it's a blessing that we've got something that can achieve those sort of results. As I said, not all the time. My results show with autism over the last 10 years, probably about a 70% success rate. And that's not bad for autism. I wish it was 100%, but it's not. And that doesn't mean that the other 30% made no progress, but it wasn't as much as we would have liked. But one of the big problems is that a lot of parents who come in, I'm the last resort, right? They've been to see a lot of other orthodox and sometimes complementary practitioners and get so far, then improvement stops. And so with some of them, if you can't give them something that's going to work in the first month, they'll move on. And I understand that. That's not a criticism of the parents. They've, you know, reached a stage of desperation. But it's a shame because every now and again you see enough of a change to know, well, look, if they kept going for another 6 months, I'm sure they'd see a very big difference. But that's life.
Is homeopathy for everyone? Is there anyone that you've seen where you're like, this is not for you? Or is it for everybody? And can it help with everything?
I think the simple, honest answer is no. To both of those, both barrels of that question. Nothing is always the best for everyone. And we're blessed with a whole range of complementary options. And, you know, for example, if I do something stupid, like, you know, chainsaw and still getting wood ready for winter and do it the wrong way and put my back out, I mean, arnica's good. That's the classic first aid for any physical traumas, but I'd be going down and seeing someone who's an expert on, you know, putting things back into place. That's a very simple example, but I mean, there are so many varieties of problems that people have. And no, homeopathy is not the perfect answer for everyone. And I think it also depends on where you're practicing. Because in somewhere like India, where that's the sort of heartland of homeopathy these days, principally because they have the government support through the Ministry of Ayush, but they also have tens, if not hundreds of millions of people using it. And, you know, I've visited a few hospitals in India in my different visits there, homeopathic hospitals. And, you know, it's so different to what we do here. You walk in and there might be 600 people in the waiting room, and you look around the walls of the, you know, where the hospital where they're all waiting in the middle, and one door will say kidneys and the other door might say liver and another door will say skin and another door will say psychological, you know, so they have so many patients that they specialize intensely in different aspects of homeopathy. And just like I have, I mean, I'm by no means a perfect practitioner in the sense that I've spent so much time on immunization and vaccine injury that I've neglected other parts of homeopathy, reading Materia Medica and, you know, looking at other cases, etc., that other practitioners do, which means that they would be better than I am in certain other areas. So, you know, life is like that. You have to make choices and put your energy to where you think it'll do the most benefit for other people. So in a place like India, most things there, they would have some sort of homeopathic approach. But then, you know, some things, some surgical things, there's no option but to have surgery. And this is where orthodox medicine can be absolutely wonderful. So I'm not opposed to orthodox medicine, full stop. What I'm opposed to is the takeover of medical systems in different countries by people who have a vested interest in preventing citizens from having access to the best option for them, whether it be pharmaceutical or non-pharmaceutical. And this is where my visits to Cuba and to India have been eye-opening. As like in Cuba, I mean, a lot of people have different things to say about Fidel Castro, and not all of them would be positive, but he loved natural medicine. And so doctors in Cuba, when I went over there, they could use drugs, they could use acupuncture, herbal medicine, homeopathic medicine, whatever they thought was the best modality or approach for that particular patient. And that's a wonderful system. You know, we could learn so much from that, but we won't, because we don't have a health system here. We have a disease management system. And the reason for that is that's how the pharmaceutical companies make most of their money, by helping people to live longer, but less healthy. And one of the worst kept secrets in Australia is that we have one of the highest rates of chronic disease in the world. And that's a shocking thing for a country like us to say. And yet, you know, you hear people saying, what a brilliant system we have. Now, parts of our system are brilliant. And there are many people in the orthodox system who are totally devoted and try to help their patients. And I feel sorry for them. So COVID is such a lesson, or should have been such a lesson to everyone, because the doctors who started to speak out and say, look, we have simple, proven, inexpensive, safe options, and including something like vitamin D supplementation to people in elderly care residential homes. I mean, we would have saved tens of thousands of lives if elderly residents had just been given decent vitamin D supplementation. And that costs a few dollars a week, you know. It's just tragic. And the doctors, as I said, who spoke out, either were deregistered or they were told that if they didn't stop speaking out, they would be deregistered. I mean, it's shameful, really is. And the so-called experts that we saw on our TVs every day ad nauseum telling us, you know, why lockdowns were so necessary and why masking was so necessary. And then when the vaccines came, how, you know, wonderful they were going to save everything. Well, you know, those experts, to be honest, were either fools or liars. They were the fools if they didn't know the truth, and if they did know the truth and they weren't speaking it, they're liars. So that's where our health system is at the moment, and it's a tragedy.
I think we can all agree that it's not a wellness or well-being industry. It is like prevention. It's not set up for us to thrive and to take back control of our own health in our family. And you know, I've been using homeopathy with my daughter since she was born. You know, when she started teething, I started using chamomilla with her. And that's all I used with her while she was teething. And I've used arnica a few times when she's had big falls. I've used that. And I had another one, a sleep and calm one that I would give her when she was teething or when she was really irritable from something. So I've used kind of those three throughout her life. And the other day she said, Mama, homeopathics, and she was pointing to her teeth. And I said, have you got a sore tooth? And looked in her mouth and one of her 2.5-year-old big molars is coming through. And I just love that she was able to express that to me and she knew what was supportive for her. Like, just so amazing. So are there any homeopathics that you would recommend that most homes have, or is it different and individual for everyone? Or are there a couple of really common ones that you think these would be great for your home?
Yep. Yes. For example, Ledum, L-E-D-U-M 30. That's a great treatment for tetanus wounds. Now, if you live in the bush like I do, you know, every now and again, you get a wound from a bit of metal that looks very suspicious. But even in the city, you know, you can have a whole range of different wounds and sometimes bites as well. But Ledum is a great remedy to have in a first aid kit, because tetanus is something definitely worth preventing or treating. Of course, if the wound bleeds freely, then that's also a very effective natural form of tetanus treatment. But particularly wounds that don't bleed freely, the lidium is great to have on hand. A remedy I always take with me when I go traveling is Nux Vomica, N-U-X-V-O-M-I-C-A. It's a great liver.
I took that when I was pregnant in my first trimester when I was feeling nauseous.
Well, there are probably about 400 or 500 remedies for nausea in the homeopathic Materia Medica. So if you've got the right one at the start, that's fantastic. See, that's the thing with homeopathy. Not any remedy will work every time. So, you know, with nausea, there's a remedy, Ipecac, which is very often used when a person has a clean, moist tongue. Now, normally, when a person feels nauseous, the tongue is coated somehow. But when the tongue is completely clean and moist, you don't need to ask any more questions. You just give them Ipecac. But Nux Vomica, to be honest with you, I use it for a totally different reason, because it's the best hangover remedy on the planet. In terms of if you're having a few too many whatevers when you're out celebrating or visiting people, it's a very useful remedy. If you remember to take it before you go to bed, it'll help an awful lot. And if you don't, well, it'll help a lot in the next morning. So it's a good remedy, but it's also, you know, a very good remedy for obstinate constipation with straining. So they talk about the, not just children, can be adults as well. It's often used with children whose constipation is that they get on the toilet, they really want to go and they strain and nothing happens. But you see, that's totally different to a remedy like Calcone, where the child can be constipated, may not have a motion for days and doesn't feel any bother at all. So that's the thing with homeopathy. It's both the good thing and the difficult thing, that you need to get the remedy that matches the symptoms of the patient. So giving a Calcard patient who had no discomfort Nux Vomica would not help at all. Or giving the Nux Vomica patient who's straining away and can't produce emotion, giving them Calcard, that wouldn't help either. So and it's the same with teething. Like chamomilla helps in about 80% of cases with teething, but it's not 100%. So, you know, there are other remedies which can be extremely effective. The child's producing massive amounts of saliva, it's worse at night. A remedy like Mercurius can be very good. For children who have a chronic teething problem, in other words, not just every now and again, but, you know, it's ongoing, the calcium group of remedies or silica can also be very good to break the pattern. So there's a lot behind each decision in a way. Now, obviously, with first aid kits, the people who prepare them, my daughter makes a very good one, they select the remedies they think will help the majority of the people the majority of the time. But it's not always 100% guarantee of success. I mean, one of the great things for homeopathy with infants is sudden onset fevers, because they can be really scary. And you certainly don't want to let a sudden onset fever get out of hand. And the other side of that, though, is that you don't want to come in with infant Panadol too quickly, because that will prevent what the fever's trying to do, which is to kill off the organism that's caused it in the first place. So there are two brilliant remedies for sudden onset fevers, aconite and belladonna, but they are both slightly different. You know, with the belladonna, you've got the glassy eyes. It looks like the person's almost been crying. They're really hot, but they're dry. The skin's dry. There's no sweat. And they can become delirious if the fever goes for too long, and sudden onset as well, as opposed to the aconite, which also can be very hot. The interesting thing with the aconite is that often they can have a burning hot head, but their hands and or their feet can be quite cold. Often the fever with the aconite will come on after they've been outside in a wind on a very windy day. And that's why it's one of our best number one croup remedies, because a lot of children who get croup it's triggered if they've been outside in very windy weather. And that can lead to that early feverish stage where aconite is perfect. So you need to have both of those remedies on hand to be able to deal with whatever type of sudden onset fever you've got, because they can, well, that can save lives. And remember, I mentioned earlier, belladonna was the remedy Hahnemann used to treat and prevent scarlet fever. So every homeopathic remedy has dozens of different uses, and in some cases, hundreds of different uses. And, you know, that is on the mental emotional side as well. So, yeah, it's a fascinating topic. But if people at home, I'd recommend if they want to try and get into treating their children at home, get a little first aid kit. I've written a little first aid booklet, which people can see on my webpage, but it's also used in a couple of other first aid kits by some big organizations. But anyone who produces a first aid kit usually has a simple little set of instructions, not too complicated, so that parents, you know, if they're in a bit of a panic, then they can come to a decision without having to sit down for an hour and try and work through a book that big, because that's what sometimes practitioners have to do in a chronic case. But that would be a great way to start. Usually you can get these things for, you know, not much more than $100, and that can last and be used by the whole family, not just children. Mum and dad can use it as well, depending on what may or may not be happening. It's a great way to start.
Yeah, we have a homeopathic first aid kit and love it. And that's what we turn to first. So I love that so much. Now, I would love to hear, if you had a magic wand and you could put one book in the school curriculum of every high school around the world, what book would you choose? Now, it doesn't have to be on homeopathics. It could be on any topic. But what is the first book that comes to mind for that, you know, 17-year-old or 15, 16, 17-year-old?
And they had to read it?
Yes. And boys and girls.
Well, to be honest, first book that came to mind was Vaccine Injured Children, the one I've just upgraded, because if young people could learn what the potential dangers of following blindly the recommendation from the orthodox health system, if they could learn that when they were 16, 17, 18, that could be something which could lead them to a life of much better health. Now, that's a very selfish and very narrowly focused answer. And I'm sure if I thought about it, I could think of other books that would be probably more useful in other ways. But in other words, if they had to read it, in other words, they couldn't just say, oh yeah, and then put it away. And it made them think, probably for the first time in their lives, that everything they've heard is not necessarily as it is. That would be enormously useful. And not just on the health, but it would be enormously useful to open people's mind, because we saw during COVID that the majority of the population just closed their minds. They didn't want to think for themselves. Neither did most politicians, by the way. They were prepared to take advice on such a critical part of their health from people who were not qualified to give that advice. They might have had a few fancy qualifications from the university, but in terms of having access to the critical factual information about what was available, what wasn't available, what really were the benefits and the downside of some of the public health measures and things like that, and social measures. You know, I think our society is a weaker society because people discouraged from thinking independently. And it's such a sad thing.
Yeah. I think we outsource our health way too much, and we need to take back the power and trust ourselves and trust our intuition so much more. You know, we can't keep outsourcing this to other people. We know ourselves better than anyone. And this has been so prominent for me since becoming a mother, and just trusting myself and trusting my intuition and just tuning into her and tuning into myself. I know her better than anybody else knows her, and I have to really trust that. But we can get pulled. We can get really pulled by very fancy marketing and very persuasive people, but we have to come back to ourselves and by fear, exactly.
That's the thing. I mean, ignorance and fear work so well together, and that's what drove most of the COVID response, was fear. People were afraid.
Yeah, absolutely. They were. They were and still are. So what have you found for people that have injuries from COVID vaccines? What have you found has been the most supportive homeopathic remedy for them?
Right. So there are different remedies to treat people who use different vaccines. So not one remedy will suit all the vaccines. So I've got different, once again, it's based around making homeopathic potencies of Pfizer, of Moderna, of AstraZeneca, et cetera. And they've been very successful, not 100%, but they've been very successful in helping people. There's another remedy which proved to be invaluable over the last 3 years. And it's a homeopathic potency of a scorpion called Boothus australis. And I originally thought that it was an Australian scorpion because it had australis in the name. But in fact, I then was told that I was wrong. And I think it's from South America. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's a very toxic scorpion. But different colleagues of mine around the planet have used different potencies of scorpion to treat the effects of the spike protein in these experimental jabs. And it's interesting because you've probably heard of the doctrine of signatures that the old naturopaths used to use. So in other words, if a herb had the shape of a heart, they'd say, this is a herb that's going to be good for the heart. Well, you look at a scorpion. What's the scorpion got on the end of its tail? A dirty grape spike. That was the perfect remedy to treat the spike protein effect. And so many people were affected by that. But it also, to a lesser extent, was useful to both treat cases of COVID as well as cases of vaccine injury. Because, you see, a vaccine is a complex thing. It's not just one thing in the vaccine that may cause an injury. It can be different aspects of it. So it was a brilliant remedy over the last 3 years to help a lot of people, whether they were vaccinated or not. I mean, initially I started using it for people who were not vaccinated but were going out mixing with vaccinated people and they'd feel terrible and work.
Yeah, because of the shedding.
Because of the shedding of the spike protein. And then people like massage therapists started using it. And they were telling me, look, if we've had a big day in the clinic, even if we feel all right before we leave to go home, we'll always have a dose of the remedy. Because we know that if we don't, we'll feel, you know, dreadful in a few hours. And I've actually published some statistics on this. There's some on my website. There's a summary of, I did two big surveys in 2021, 2022. The 2021 survey, I think, is summarized on the web, on a page on the website. People can have a look at that if they like and look for the remedy BUAU, Boothus australis. And that's the remedy for the spike protein. And yeah, if I've ever been out to a public place with a lot of people and feel a little bit off that night, I'll have a dose. Usually it only needs one or two doses and that's enough.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah, but you've got to go differently with each different vaccine. You know, so giving someone who's affected by Pfizer a potency of the AstraZeneca, that's not going to help.
Yeah. Okay. Understandable. So this has been so amazing. I have loved this conversation. I would love to do a little rapid fire with you now. Are you ready?
I think I'm game.
Don't worry. It's easy. What is one thing that we can do for our health? Just one thing that we can all start to do today.
Release blame and guilt.
Yes. To others and to ourselves.
Absolutely.
Okay. What is one thing that we can do for more wealth in our life? So more abundance in all areas of our life.
Well, I guess the Buddha would say be free of desire. Because if you desire wealth for wealth's sake, then it's often a case when it doesn't work out so well. Whereas if you're free from desire and you are working in a productive, empathetic way, whatever you need come to you. Now, that sounds very theoretical, but boy, I've seen it with a lot of people. Yeah, it's interesting. And see, wealth is such a difficult word because for many people, wealth just means money. For other people, health is wealth. That if their health is really good, that they're as wealthy as they need to be. For me, peace of mind. If one can be at peace, whatever is happening around you, physically, mentally, or emotionally, money can't buy that. I mean, you can take classes, you can listen to tapes, all of those things can help for a bit. But if you can really find peace of mind, that's like my first answer. You know, that is how we prosper. And if you're free of desire, you know, if you don't say, well, if I don't earn $100,000 this year, I'm a failure, that's not the way to look at it, because you might earn $80,000 or you might earn $60,000. But if you've got peace of mind and you've got support from caring family and friends, you're wealthier than someone who earns $1 million a year and is unhappy and stressed, and, you know, gets no real satisfaction out of it and is popping pills, Lux Vomica, probably not. So, yeah, that's the sort of wealth.
Beautiful. And the last one, what is one thing that we can do for more love in our life?
Well, the first thing you've got to do is love yourself. If you don't love and respect yourself, it's going to be very difficult to love and respect other people. And once again, it's that old sort of religious thing which says, if we don't forgive others, you know, we will carry a negative burden from that. And love, I think, comes from being non-judgmental. And I thought, well, that's essential, but also respecting and loving yourself so that you can then share that with other people. That's my answer.
Absolutely. So beautiful. Is there anything else that you want to share? Any last parting words of wisdom or anything that you really wanted to talk about?
Well, look, Melissa, thank you for our lovely conversation. It has been a lovely conversation. I hope I haven't been too serious too often. But I really worry about Australia, just as I worry about many other countries on the planet, because I think that we're moving away from simple honesty. And I mean, that's one thing I used to love about Australia decades ago. We were much less complex, but I think we were a lot more direct. People always used to say, you know, Aussies were easygoing and they're welcoming. And I think those things are wonderful. Now, you know, if you don't fit people's idea of what you should be like or think the way they think you should think, they're not accepting. And I don't think as a country we're as open and as accepting for others as we used to be. And I find that very sad. So that's the thing I'd love to see change. And of course, the problem is our leaders have been very poor quality. And not wanting to get political, because I say that about our leaders on both sides, and including and particularly the Greens since Bob Brown left. You know, when old Hawke and Keating were going, there was a certain flamboyance about it, but it was a really Australian partnership of those two. And they did a lot of very good thing because they brought most of the country together. They'll never bring everyone together. Someone's always going to be a Labor person. Someone's always going to be a Liberal. You'll never change that. You don't need to. But if the majority are living harmoniously and respectfully, which we were, I feel, much more than we are now, the place was a better place. So that's what I'd love to see. And I hope, you know, people think about being less judgmental, less critical, and more open in a genuine, honest, matter-of-fact way rather than some theoretical, you know, this should be the way it's done. Practical honesty and compassion are very important.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for your honesty and for sharing everything with us today. I will link to your website and everything that we've mentioned in the show notes for everyone to go and check out. But thank you for helping and serving and supporting so many people along their journey. I'd love to know now how I and the listeners can give back and serve you today.
Oh, well, I don't need anything specific. Well, be nice to everyone else you run across and think about, you know, what's happening here to us all. I think if we all really thought about what's happening, we would make better decisions. I know since COVID, the percentage of the population have become much more aware. That was the one only good thing from the COVID debacle, that there's probably 20% of the population really had their eyes open, but it's still the minority. We need 51% of the population to have their eyes open so that then we can get some better leadership and hopefully, you know, make some real progress back to there. I don't want anything personally.
Well, thank you again for sharing and for being so honest and for providing this wisdom and this other alternative to vaccines that most people aren't even aware of. So thank you for that. And it's been such a pleasure to chat with you and to get to know you. And I am so grateful. So thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Wasn't that mind-blowing? Seriously, don't you just wish we all had this knowledge from day one? How amazing would that be to grow up with this wisdom and knowledge? So now that you know all of this, live it in your family, teach your children, and that is how we will create a healthier and happier future. So I hope you got a lot out of this episode. And if you did, please subscribe to the show and leave me a review on Apple Podcasts, because that means that we can inspire and educate even more people together. And it also means that all of my episodes will just pop up in your feed so that you never have to go searching for a new episode. Now, come and tell me on Instagram at Melissa Ambrosini what you got from this episode. I absolutely love hearing from you and connecting with you. So jump on over to Instagram and do that now. And before I go, I just wanted to say thank you so much for being here, for wanting to be the best, the healthiest, and the happiest version of yourself, and for showing up today for you. You rock. Now, if there's someone in your life that you can think of that would really benefit from this episode, please share it with them right now. You can take a screenshot, share it on your social media, email it to them, text it to them, do whatever you've got to do to get this in their ears. And until next time, don't forget that love is sexy, healthy is liberating, and wealthy isn't a dirty word. Don't forget to head to shelaunch.com to register for my free 3-day six-figure solopreneur challenge from April 29 to May 1st. I am so excited to see you there.